Simon & Schuster Audio presents Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and It's All Small Stuff. Simple Ways to Keep the Little Things from Taking Over Your Life. Written and read by Richard Carlson, Ph.D.
The greatest discovery of my generation is that a human being can alter his life by altering his attitude. William James. Whenever we're dealing with bad news, a difficult person, or a disappointment of some kind, most of us get into certain habits, ways of reacting to life, particularly adversity, that don't serve us very well. We overreact, blow things out of proportion, hold on too tightly, and focus on the negative aspects of life. When we are immobilized by little things, when we are irritated, annoyed, and easily bothered, our overreactions not only make us frustrated, but actually get in the way of getting what we want. We lose sight of the bigger picture, focus on the negative, and annoy other people who might otherwise help us. In short, we live our lives as if they were one great big emergency. We often rush around looking busy, trying to solve problems, but in reality, we are often compounding them. Because everything seems like such a big deal, we end up spending our lives dealing with one drama after another. After a while, we begin to believe that everything really is a big deal. We fail to recognize that the way we relate to our problems has a lot to do with how quickly and efficiently we solve them. As I hope you will soon discover, when you learn the habit of responding to life with more ease, problems that seemed insurmountable will begin to seem more manageable. And even the biggies, things that are truly stressful, won't throw you off track as much as they once did. Happily, there is another way to relate to life, a softer, more graceful path that makes life seem easier and the people in it more compatible. This other way of living involves replacing old habits of reaction with new habits of perspective. These new habits enable us to have richer, more satisfying lives. I'd like to share a personal story that touched my heart and reinforced an important lesson, a story that demonstrates the essential message of this audiobook. As you will see, the events of this story planted the seed for the title of the audiobook you are about to hear. About a year ago, a foreign publisher contacted me and requested that I attempt to get an endorsement from best-selling author Dr. Wayne Dyer for a foreign edition of my book, You Can Feel Good Again. I told them that while Dr. Dyer had given me an endorsement for an earlier book, I had no idea whether or not he would consider doing so again. I told them, however, that I would try. As is often the case in the publishing world, I sent out my request but did not hear back. After some time had gone by, I came to the conclusion that Dr. Dyer was either too busy or unwilling to write an endorsement. I honored this decision and let the publisher know that we wouldn't be able to use his name to promote the book. I considered the case closed. About 6 months later, however, I received a copy of the foreign edition, and to my surprise, right on the cover was the old endorsement for the earlier book from Dr. Dyer. Despite my specific instructions to the contrary, the foreign publisher had used his earlier quote and transferred it to the new book. I was extremely upset and worried about the implications as well as the possible consequences. I called my literary agent, who immediately contacted the publisher and demanded that the books be taken off the shelves. In the meantime, I decided to write Dr. Dyer an apology, explaining the situation and all that was being done to rectify the problem. After a few weeks of wondering what his response might be, I received a letter in the mail that said the following. Richard, there are two rules for living in harmony. Number one, don't sweat the small stuff. Number two, it's all small stuff. Let the quote stand. Love, Wayne. That was it. No lectures, no threats, no hard feelings, and no confrontation. Despite the obvious unethical use of his very famous name, he responded with grace and humility, no feathers ruffled. His response demonstrated the important concepts of going with the flow and of learning to respond to life gracefully with ease. For more than a decade, I have worked with clients, helping them to approach life in this more accepting way. Together, we deal with all types of issues: stress, relationship problems, work-related issues, addictions, and general frustration. In this audiobook, I will share with you very specific strategies, things you can start doing today that will help you respond to life more gracefully. The strategies you are going to hear about are the ones that have proven themselves to be the most successful by clients and readers of mine over the years. They also represent the way I like to approach my own life, the path of least resistance. Each strategy is simple, yet powerful, and will act as a navigational guide to point you in the direction of greater perspective and more relaxed living. You'll find that many of the strategies will apply not only to isolated events, but to many of life's most difficult challenges. When you don't sweat the small stuff, your life won't be perfect, but you will learn to accept what life has to offer with far less resistance. As we learn in the Zen philosophy, when you learn to let go of problems instead of resisting with all your might, your life will begin to flow. You will, as the Serenity Prayer suggests, change the things that can be changed, accept those that cannot, and have the wisdom to know the difference. I'm confident that if you give these strategies a try, you will learn the two rules of harmony: don't sweat the small stuff, and it's all small stuff. As you incorporate these ideas into your life, you will begin to create a more peaceful and loving you.
Don't sweat the small stuff.
Often, we allow ourselves to get all worked up about things that, upon closer examination, aren't really that big a deal. We focus on little problems and concerns and blow them way out of proportion. A stranger, for example, might cut in front of us in traffic. Rather than let it go and go on with our day, we convince ourselves that we are justified in our anger. We play out an imaginary confrontation in our mind. Many of us might even tell someone else about the incident later on, rather than simply let it go. Why not instead simply allow the driver to have his accident somewhere else? Try to have compassion for the person and remember how painful it is to be in such an enormous hurry. This way, we can maintain our own sense of well-being and avoid taking other people's problems personally. There are many similar small stuff examples that occur every day in our lives. Whether we had to wait in line, listen to unfair criticism, or do the lion's share of the work, it pays enormous dividends if we learn not to worry about little things. So many people spend so much of their life energy sweating the small stuff that they completely lose touch with the magic and beauty of life. When you commit to working toward this goal, you will find that you will have far more energy to be kinder and gentler.
Make peace with imperfection.
I've yet to meet an absolute perfectionist whose life was filled with inner peace. The need for perfection and the desire for inner tranquility conflict with each other. Whenever we are attached to having something a certain way, better than it already is, we are, almost by definition, engaged in a losing battle. Rather than being content and grateful for what we have, we are focused on what's wrong with something and our need to fix it. When we are zeroed in on what's wrong, it implies that we are dissatisfied, discontent. Whether it's related to ourselves, a disorganized closet, a scratch on the car, an imperfect accomplishment, a few pounds we would like to lose, or someone else's imperfections, the way someone looks, behaves, or lives their life, the very act of focusing on imperfection pulls us away from our goal of being kind and gentle. This strategy has nothing to do with ceasing to do your very best, but with being overly attached and focused on what's wrong with life. It's about realizing that while there's always a better way to do something, this doesn't mean that you can't enjoy and appreciate the way things already are. The solution here is to catch yourself when you fall into your habit of insisting that things should be other than they are. Gently remind yourself that life is okay the way it is, right now. In the absence of your judgment, everything would be fine. As you begin to eliminate your need for perfection in all areas of your life, you'll begin to discover the perfection in life itself.
Let go of the idea that gentle, relaxed people can't be superachievers.
One of the major reasons so many of us remain hurried, frightened, and competitive, and continue to live life as if it were one giant emergency, is our fear that if we were to become more peaceful and loving, we would suddenly stop achieving our goals. We would become lazy and apathetic. You can put this fear to rest by realizing that the opposite is actually true. Fearful, frantic thinking takes an enormous amount of energy and drains the creativity and motivation from our lives. When you are fearful or frantic, you literally immobilize yourself from your greatest potential, not to mention enjoyment. Any success that you do have is despite your fear, not because of it. I have had the good fortune to surround myself with some very relaxed, peaceful, and loving people. Some of these people are best-selling authors, loving parents, counselors, computer experts, and chief executive officers. All of them are fulfilled in what they do and are very proficient at their given skills. I have learned the important lesson. When you have what you want, inner peace, you are less distracted by your wants, needs, desires, and concerns. It's thus easier to concentrate, focus, achieve your goals, and give back to others.
Be aware of the snowball effect of your thinking.
A powerful technique for becoming more peaceful is to be aware of how quickly your negative and insecure thinking can spiral out of control. Have you ever noticed how uptight you feel when you're caught up in your thinking? And, to top it off, the more absorbed you get in the details of whatever is upsetting you, the worse you feel. One thought leads to another, and yet another, until at some point you become incredibly agitated. For example, you might wake up in the middle of the night and remember a phone call that needs to be made the following day. Then, rather than feeling relieved that you remembered such an important call, you start thinking about everything else you have to do tomorrow. You start rehearsing a probable conversation with your boss, getting yourself even more upset. Pretty soon you think to yourself, "I can't believe how busy I am. I must make 50 phone calls a day. Whose life is this anyway?" And on it goes until you're feeling sorry for yourself. For many people, there's no limit to how long this type of thought attack can go on. In fact, I've been told by clients that many of their days and nights are spent in this type of mental rehearsal. Needless to say, it's impossible to feel peaceful with your head full of concerns and annoyances. The solution is to notice what's happening in your head before your thoughts have a chance to build any momentum. The sooner you catch yourself in the act of building your mental snowball, the easier it is to stop. In our example here, you might notice your snowball thinking right when you start running through the list of what you have to do the next day. Then, instead of obsessing on your upcoming day, you say to yourself, "Whew, there I go again," and consciously nip it in the bud. You stop your train of thought before it has a chance to get going. You can then focus not on how overwhelmed you are, but on how grateful you are for remembering the phone call that needed to be made. If it's in the middle of the night, write it down on a piece of paper and go back to sleep. You might even consider keeping a pen and paper by the bed for such moments. You may indeed be a very busy person, but remember that filling your head with thoughts of how overwhelmed you are only exacerbates the problem by making you feel even more stressed than you already do. Try this simple little exercise the next time you begin to obsess on your schedule. You'll be amazed at how effective it can be.
Develop your compassion.
Nothing helps us build our perspective more than developing compassion for others. Compassion is a sympathetic feeling. It involves the willingness to put yourself in someone else's shoes, to take the focus off yourself, and to imagine what it's like to be in someone else's predicament, and simultaneously, to feel love for that person. It's the recognition that other people's problems, their pain, and frustrations are every bit as real as our own, often far worse. In recognizing this fact and trying to offer some assistance, we open our own hearts and greatly enhance our sense of gratitude. Compassion is something you can develop with practice. It involves two things, intention and action. Intention simply means you remember to open your heart to others. You expand what and who matters from yourself to other people. Action is simply the what you do about it. You might donate a little money or time, or both, on a regular basis to a cause near to your heart. Or perhaps you'll offer a beautiful smile and a genuine hello to the people you meet on the street. It's not so important what you do, just that you do something. As Mother Teresa reminded us, we cannot do great things on this earth. We can only do small things with great love. Compassion develops your sense of gratitude by taking your attention off all the little things that most of us have learned to take too seriously. When you take time, often, to reflect on the miracle of life, the gift of sight, of love, and all the rest, it can help to remind you that many of the things that you think of as big stuff are really just small stuff that you are turning into big stuff.
Remind yourself that when you die, your in-basket won't be empty.
So many of us live our lives as if the secret purpose is to somehow get everything done. We stay up late, get up early, avoid having fun, and keep our loved ones waiting. Sadly, I've seen many people who put off their loved ones so long that the loved ones lose interest in maintaining the relationship. I used to do this myself. Often, we convince ourselves that our obsession with our to-do list is only temporary, that once we get through the list, we'll be calm, relaxed, and happy. But in reality, this rarely happens. As items are checked off, new ones simply replace them. The nature of your in-basket is that it's meant to have items to be completed in it. It's not meant to be empty. There will always be phone calls that need to be made, projects to complete, and work to be done. In fact, it can be argued that a full in-basket is essential for success. It means your time is in demand. Regardless of who you are or what you do, however, remember that nothing is more important than your own sense of happiness and inner peace and that of your loved ones. If you're obsessed with getting everything done, you'll never have a sense of well-being. In reality, almost everything can wait. Very little in our work lives truly falls into the emergency category. If you stay focused on your work, it will all get done in due time. I find that if I remind myself frequently that the purpose of life isn't to get it all done, but to enjoy each step along the way and live a life filled with love, it's far easier for me to control my obsession with completing my list of things to do. Remember, when you die, there will still be unfinished business to take care of. And you know what? Someone else will do it for you. Don't waste any more precious moments of your life regretting the inevitable.
Don't interrupt others or finish their sentences.
It wasn't until a few years ago that I realized how often I interrupted others and/or finished their sentences. Shortly thereafter, I also realized how destructive this habit was, not only to the respect and love I received from others, but also for the tremendous amount of energy it takes to try and be in two heads at once. Think about it for a moment. When you hurry someone along, interrupt someone, or finish his or her sentence, you have to keep track not only of your own thoughts, but of those of the person you're interrupting as well. This tendency, which by the way is extremely common in busy people, encourages both parties to speed up their speech and their thinking. This, in turn, makes both people nervous, irritable, and annoyed. It's downright exhausting. It's also the cause of many arguments, because if there's one thing almost everyone resents, it's someone who doesn't listen to what they're saying. And how can you really listen to what someone is saying when you're speaking for that person? Once you begin noticing yourself interrupting others, you'll see that this insidious tendency is nothing more than an innocent habit that has become invisible to you. This is good news because it means that all you really have to do is begin catching yourself when you forget. Remind yourself, before a conversation begins if possible, to be patient and wait. Tell yourself to allow the other person to finish speaking before you take your turn. You'll notice right away how much the interactions with the people in your life will improve as a direct result of this simple act. the people you communicate with will feel much more relaxed around you when they feel heard and listened to. You'll also notice how much more relaxed you'll feel when you stop interrupting others. Your heart and pulse rates will slow down, and you'll begin to enjoy your conversations rather than rush through them. This is an easy way to become a more relaxed, loving person.
Do something nice for someone else, and don't tell anyone about it.
While many of us frequently do nice things for others, we are almost certain to mention our acts of kindness to someone else, secretly seeking their approval. When we share our own niceness or generosity with someone else, it makes us feel like we are thoughtful people. It reminds us of how nice we are and how deserving we are of kindness. While all acts of kindness are inherently wonderful, there is something even more magical about doing something thoughtful but mentioning it to no one, ever. You always feel good when you give to others. Rather than diluting the positive feelings by telling others about your own kindness, by keeping it to yourself, you get to retain all the positive feelings. It's really true that one should give for the sake of giving, not to receive something in return. This is precisely what you are doing when you don't mention your kindness to others. Your rewards are the warm feelings that come from the act of giving. The next time you do something really nice for someone else, keep it to yourself and revel in the abundant joy of giving.
Let others have the glory.
There is something magical that happens to the human spirit, a sense of calm that comes over you when you cease needing all the attention directed toward yourself and instead allow others to have the glory. Our need for excessive attention is that ego-centered part of us that says, "Look at me, I'm special. My story is more interesting than yours." It's that voice inside of us that may not come right out and say it, but that wants to believe that my accomplishments are slightly more important than yours. The ego is that part of us that wants to be seen, heard, respected, considered special, often at the expense of someone else. It's the part of us that interrupts someone else's story or impatiently waits his turn to speak so that he can bring the conversation and attention back to himself. To varying degrees, most of us engage in this habit, much to our own detriment. When you immediately dive in and bring the conversation back toward you, you can subtly minimize the joy that person has in sharing, and in doing so, create distance between yourself and others. Everyone loses. The next time someone tells you a story or shares an accomplishment with you, notice your tendency to say something about yourself in response. Although it's a difficult habit to break, it's not only enjoyable but actually peaceful to have the quiet confidence to be able to surrender your need for attention and instead share in the joy of someone else's glory. Rather than jumping right in and saying, "Once I did the same thing," or "Guess what I did today," bite your tongue and notice what happens. Just say, "That's wonderful," or "Please tell me more," and leave it at that. The person you are speaking to will have so much more fun, and because you are so much more present, because you are listening so carefully, he or she won't feel in competition with you. The result will be that the person will feel more relaxed around you, making him or her more confident as well as more interesting. You too will feel more relaxed because you won't be on the edge of your seat waiting your turn. Obviously, there are many times when it's absolutely appropriate to exchange experience back and forth and to share in the glory and attention rather than giving it all away. I'm referring here to the compulsive need to grab it from others. Ironically, when you surrender your need to hog the glory, the attention you used to need from other people is replaced by a quiet inner confidence that is derived from letting others have it.
Learn to live in the present moment.
To a large degree, the measure of our peace of mind is determined by how much we are able to live in the present moment. Irrespective of what happened yesterday or last year, and what may or may not happen tomorrow, the present moment is where you are, always. Without question, many of us have mastered the neurotic art of spending much of our lives worrying about a variety of things all at once. We allow past problems and future concerns to dominate our present moments, so much so that we end up anxious, frustrated, depressed, and hopeless. On the flip side, we also postpone our gratification, our stated priorities, and our happiness, often convincing ourselves that someday will be better than today. Unfortunately, the same mental dynamics that tell us to look toward the future will only repeat themselves so that someday never actually arrives. John Lennon once said, "Life is what's happening while we're busy making other plans." When we're busy making other plans, our children are busy growing up, the people we love are moving away and dying, our bodies are getting out of shape, and our dreams are slipping away. In short, we miss out on life. Many people live as if life were a dress rehearsal for some later date. It isn't. In fact, no one has a guarantee that he or she will be here tomorrow. Now is the only time we have, and the only time that we have any control over. When our attention is in the present moment, we push fear from our minds. Fear is the concern over events that might happen in the future. We won't have enough money, our children will get into trouble, we will get old and die, whatever. To combat fear, the best strategy is to learn to bring your attention back to the present. Mark Twain said, "I have been through some terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened." I don't think I can say it any better. Practice keeping your attention on the here and now. Your efforts will pay great dividends.
Imagine that everyone is enlightened except you.
This strategy gives you a chance to practice something that is probably completely unacceptable to you. However, if you give it a try, you might find that it's one of the most helpful exercises in self-improvement. As the title suggests, the idea is to imagine that everyone you know and everyone you meet is perfectly enlightened. That is, everyone except you. The people you meet are all here to teach you something. Perhaps the obnoxious driver or disrespectful teenager is here to teach you about patience. The punk rocker might be here to teach you to be less judgmental. Your job is to try to determine what the people in your life are trying to teach you. You'll find that if you do this, you'll be far less annoyed, bothered, and frustrated by the actions and imperfections of other people. You can actually get yourself in the habit of approaching life in this manner, and if you do, you'll be glad you did. Often, once you discover what someone is trying to teach you, it's easy to let go of your frustration. For example, suppose you're in the post office and the postal clerk appears to be intentionally moving slowly. Rather than feeling frustrated, ask yourself the question, "What is he trying to teach me?" Maybe you need to learn about compassion, how hard it would be to have a job that you don't like. Or perhaps you could learn a little more about being patient. Standing in line is an excellent opportunity to break your habit of feeling impatient. You may be surprised at how fun and easy this is. All you're really doing is changing your perception from, "Why are they doing this?" to, "What are they trying to teach me?" Take a look around today at all the enlightened people.
Let others be right most of the time.
One of the most important questions you can ever ask yourself is, do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? Many times the two are mutually exclusive. Being right, defending our positions, takes an enormous amount of mental energy and often alienates us from the people in our lives. Needing to be right or needing someone else to be wrong encourages others to become defensive and puts pressure on us to keep defending. Yet many of us, me too at times, spend a great deal of time and energy attempting to prove or point out that we are right and or others are wrong. Many people, consciously or unconsciously, believe that it's somehow their job to show others how their positions, statements, and points of view are incorrect, and that in doing so, the person they are correcting is going to somehow appreciate it or at least learn something. Wrong. Think about it. Have you ever been corrected by someone and said to the person who was trying to be right, "Thank you so much for showing me that I was wrong and you're right. Now I see it. Boy, you're great." Or has anyone you know ever thanked you or even agreed with you when you corrected them or made yourself right at their expense? Of course not. The truth is, all of us hate to be corrected. We all want our positions to be respected and understood by others. Being listened to and heard is one of the greatest desires of the human heart, and those who learn to listen are the most loved and respected. Those who are in the habit of correcting others are often resented and avoided. It's not that it's never appropriate to be right. Sometimes you genuinely need to be or want to be. Perhaps there are certain philosophical positions that you don't want to budge on, such as when you hear a racist comment. Here, it's important to speak your mind. Usually, however, it's just your ego creeping in and ruining an otherwise peaceful encounter, a habit of wanting or needing to be right. A wonderful, heartfelt strategy for becoming more peaceful and loving is to practice allowing others the joy of being right. Give them the glory. Stop correcting. As hard as it may be to change this habit, it's worth any effort and practice it takes. When someone says, "I really feel it's important to," rather than jumping in and saying, "No, it's more important to," or any of the hundreds of other forms of conversational editing, simply let it go and allow their statement to stand. The people in your life will become less defensive and more loving. They will appreciate you more than you could have ever dreamed possible, even if they don't know exactly why. You'll discover the joy of participating in and witnessing other people's happiness, which is far more rewarding than a battle of egos. You don't have to sacrifice your deepest philosophical truths or most heartfelt opinions, but starting today, let others be right most of the time.
Become more patient.
The quality of patience goes a long way toward your goal of creating a more peaceful and loving self. The more patient you are, the more accepting you will be of what is, rather than insisting that life be exactly as you would like it to be. Without patience, life is extremely frustrating. You are easily annoyed, bothered, and irritated. Patience adds a dimension of ease and acceptance to your life. It's essential for inner peace. Becoming more patient involves opening your heart to the present moment, even if you don't like it. If you are stuck in a traffic jam, late for an appointment, opening to the moment would mean catching yourself building a mental snowball before your thinking got out of hand and gently reminding yourself to relax. It might also be a good time to breathe, as well as an opportunity to remind yourself that, in the bigger scheme of things, being late is small stuff. Patience also involves seeing the innocence in others. My wife Chris and I have two young children. On many occasions while writing Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, our four-year-old daughter walked into my office and interrupted my work, which can be disruptive to a writer. What I have learned to do, most of the time, is to see the innocence in her behavior rather than to focus on the potential implications of her interruption. I won't get my work done, I'll lose my train of thought, this was my only opportunity to write today, and so forth. I remind myself why she is coming in to see me, because she loves me, not because she is conspiring to ruin my work. When I remember to see the innocence, I immediately bring forth a feeling of patience, and my attention is brought back to the moment. Any irritation that may have been building is eliminated, and I'm reminded once again of how fortunate I am to have such beautiful children. I have found that, if you look deeply enough, you can almost always see the innocence in other people, as well as in potentially frustrating situations. When you do, you will become a more patient and peaceful person, and, in some strange way, you will begin to enjoy many of the moments that used to frustrate you.
Create patience practice periods.
Patience is a quality of heart that can be greatly enhanced with deliberate practice. An effective way that I have found to deepen my own patience is to create actual practice periods, periods of time that I set up in my mind to practice the art of patience. Life itself becomes a classroom, and the curriculum is patience. You can start with as little as 5 minutes and build up your capacity for patience over time. Start by saying to yourself, "Okay, for the next 5 minutes, I won't allow myself to be bothered by anything. I'll be patient." What you'll discover is truly amazing. Your intention to be patient, especially if you know it's only for a short while, immediately strengthens your capacity for patience. Patience is one of those special qualities where success feeds on itself. Once you reach little milestones, 5 minutes of successful patience, you'll begin to see that you do indeed have the capacity to be patient even for longer periods of time. Over time, you may even become a patient person. Since I have young children at home, I have many possibilities to practice the art of patience. For example, on a day when both girls are firing questions at me as I'm trying to make important phone calls, I'll say to myself, "Now is a great time to be patient. For the next half hour, I'm going to be as patient as possible. See, I've worked hard. I'm up to 30 minutes. All kidding aside, it really works, and it has worked in our family. As I keep my cool and don't allow myself to be annoyed and upset, I can calmly, yet firmly, direct my children's behavior far more effectively than when I get crazy. The simple act of gearing my mind toward patience allows me to remain in the present moment far more than I would if I were upset, thinking about all the times that this has happened before and feeling like a martyr. What's more, my patient feelings are often contagious. They rub off on the kids, who then decide on their own that it's no fun to bother Dad. Being patient allows me to keep my perspective. I can remember, even in the midst of a difficult situation, that what's before me, my present challenge, isn't life or death, but simply a minor obstacle that must be dealt with. Without patience, the same scenario can become a major emergency, complete with yelling, frustration, hurt feelings, and high blood pressure. It's really not worth all that. Whether you're needing to deal with children, your boss, or a difficult person or situation, if you don't want to sweat the small stuff, improving your patience level is a great way to start.
Be the first one to act loving or reach out.
So many of us hold on to little resentments that may have stemmed from an argument, a misunderstanding, the way we were raised, or some other painful event. Stubbornly, we wait for someone else to reach out to us, believing this is the only way we can forgive or rekindle a friendship or family relationship. An acquaintance of mine, whose health isn't very good, recently told me she hasn't spoken to her son in almost 3 years. "Why not?" I asked. She said that she and her son had had a disagreement about his wife and that she wouldn't speak to him again unless he called first. When I suggested that she be the one to reach out, she resisted initially and said, "I can't do that. He's the one who should apologize." She was literally willing to die before reaching out to her only son. After a little gentle encouragement, however, she did decide to be the first one to reach out. To her amazement, her son was grateful for her willingness to call and offered an apology of his own. As is usually the case, when someone takes the chance and reaches out, everyone wins. Whenever we hold on to our anger, we turn small stuff into really big stuff in our minds. We start to believe that our positions are more important than our happiness. They are not. If you want to be a more peaceful person, you must understand that being right is almost never more important than allowing yourself to be happy. The way to be happy is to let go and reach out. Let other people be right. This doesn't mean that you're wrong. Everything will be fine. You'll experience the peace of letting go, as well as the joy of letting others be right. You'll also notice that, as you reach out and let others be right, they will become less defensive and more loving toward you. They might even reach back. But if for some reason they don't, that's okay too. You'll have the inner satisfaction of knowing that you have done your part to create a more loving world, and certainly you'll be more peaceful yourself.
Ask yourself the question, will this matter a year from now?
Almost every day I play a game with myself that I call Time Warp. I made it up in response to my consistent, erroneous belief that what I was all worked up about was really important. To play Time Warp, all you have to do is imagine that whatever circumstance you are dealing with isn't happening right now, but a year from now. Then simply ask yourself, is this situation really as important as I'm making it out to be? Once in a great while, it may be, but a vast majority of the time, it simply isn't. Whether it be an argument with your spouse, child, or boss, a mistake, a lost opportunity, a lost wallet, a work-related rejection, or a sprained ankle, chances are a year from now you aren't going to care. It will be one more irrelevant detail in your life. While this simple game won't solve all your problems, it can give you an enormous amount of needed perspective. I find myself laughing at things that I used to take far too seriously. Now, rather than using up my energy feeling angry and overwhelmed, I can use it instead on spending time with my wife and children or engaging in creative thinking.
Surrender to the fact that life isn't fair.
A friend of mine, in response to a conversation we were having about the injustices of life, asked me the question, who said life was going to be fair, or that it was even meant to be fair? Her question was a good one. It reminded me of something I was taught as a youngster. Life isn't fair. It's a bummer, but it's absolutely true. Ironically, recognizing the sobering fact can be a very liberating insight. One of the mistakes many of us make is that we feel sorry for ourselves or for others, thinking that life should be fair, or that someday it will be. It's not, and it won't. When we make this mistake, we tend to spend a lot of time wallowing and/or complaining about what's wrong with life. We commiserate with others, discussing the injustices of life. It's not fair, we complain, not realizing that perhaps it was never intended to be. One of the nice things about surrendering to the fact that life isn't fair is that it keeps us from feeling sorry for ourselves by encouraging us to do the very best that we can with what we have. We know it's not life's job to make everything perfect. It's our own challenge. Surrendering to this fact also keeps us from feeling sorry for others because we are reminded that everyone is dealt a different hand and everyone has unique strengths and challenges. This insight has helped me to deal with the problems of raising two children, the difficult decisions I've had to make about who to help and who I can't help, as well as with my own personal struggles during those times that I have felt victimized or unfairly treated. It almost always wakes me up to reality and puts me back on track. The fact that life isn't fair doesn't mean we shouldn't do everything in our power to improve our own lives or the world as a whole. To the contrary, it suggests that we should. When we don't recognize or admit that life isn't fair, we tend to feel pity for others and for ourselves. Pity, of course, is a self-defeating emotion that does nothing for anyone except to make everyone feel worse than they already do. When we do recognize that life isn't fair, however, we feel compassion for others and for ourselves. And compassion is a heartfelt emotion that delivers loving kindness to everyone it touches. The next time you find yourself thinking about the injustices of the world, try reminding yourself of this very basic fact. You may be surprised that it can nudge you out of self-pity and into helpful action.
Allow yourself to be bored.
For many of us, our lives are so filled with stimuli, not to mention responsibilities, that it's almost impossible for us to sit still and do nothing, much less relax, even for a few minutes. A friend of mine said to me, "People are no longer human beings. We should be called human doings." I was first exposed to the idea that occasional boredom can actually be good for me while studying with a therapist in Laconia, Washington, a tiny little town with very little to do. After finishing our first day together, I asked my instructor, "What is there to do around here at night?" He responded by saying, "What I'd like you to do is allow yourself to be bored. Do nothing. This is part of your training." At first, I thought he was kidding. "Why on earth would I choose to be bored?" I asked. He went on to explain that if you allow yourself to be bored, even for an hour or less, and don't fight it, the feelings of boredom will be replaced with feelings of peace. And after a little practice, you'll learn to relax. Much to my surprise, he was absolutely right. At first, I could barely stand it. I was so used to doing something every second that I really struggled to relax. But after a while, I got used to it and have long since learned to enjoy it. I'm not talking about hours of idle time or laziness, but simply learning the art of relaxing, of just being rather than doing, for a few minutes each day. There isn't a specific technique other than to consciously do nothing. Just sit still, perhaps look out the window and notice your thoughts and feelings. At first, you may get a little anxious, but each day it will get a little easier. The payback is tremendous. Much of our anxiety and inner struggle stems from our busy, overactive minds always needing something to entertain them, something to focus on, and always wondering what's next. While we're eating dinner, we wonder what's for dessert. While eating dessert, we ponder what we should do afterward. After that evening, it's, what should we do this weekend? After we've been out, we walk into the house and immediately turn on the television, pick up the phone, open a book, or start cleaning. It's almost as though we're frightened at the thought of not having something to do, even for a minute. The beauty of doing nothing is that it teaches you to clear your mind and relax. It allows your mind the freedom to not know for a brief period of time. Just like your body, your mind needs an occasional break from its hectic routine. When you allow your mind to take a break, it comes back stronger, sharper, more focused, and creative. When you allow yourself to be bored, it takes an enormous amount of pressure off you to be performing and doing something every second of every day. Now, when either of my two children says to me, "Daddy, I'm bored," I respond by saying, "Great, be bored for a while, it's good for you." Once I say this, they always give up on the idea of me solving their problem. You probably never thought someone would actually suggest that you allow yourself to be bored. I guess there's a first for everything.
Lower your tolerance to stress.
It seems that we have it backward in our society. We tend to look up to people who are under a great deal of stress, who can handle loads of stress, and those who are under a great deal of pressure. When someone says, "I've been working really hard," or "I'm really stressed out," we are taught to admire, even emulate their behavior. In my work as a stress consultant, I hear the proud words, "I have a very high tolerance to stress," almost every day. It probably won't come as a surprise that when these stressed-out people first arrive at my office, more often than not, what they are hoping for are strategies to raise their tolerance to stress even higher so they can handle even more. Fortunately, there is an inviolable law in our emotional environment that goes something like this. Our current level of stress will be exactly that of our tolerance to stress. You'll notice that the people who say, "I can handle lots of stress," will always be under a great deal of it. So, if you teach people to raise their tolerance to stress, that's exactly what will happen. They will accept even more confusion and responsibility until, again, their external level of stress matches that of their tolerance. Usually, it takes a crisis of some kind to wake up a stressed-out person to their own craziness. A spouse leaves, a health issue emerges, a serious addiction takes over their life, something happens that jolts them into a search for a new kind of strategy. It may seem strange, but if you were to enroll in the average stress management workshop, what you would probably learn is to raise your tolerance to stress. It seems that even stress consultants are stressed out. What you want to start doing is noticing your stress early, before it gets out of hand. When you feel your mind moving too quickly, it's time to back off and regain your bearings. When your schedule is getting out of hand, it's a signal that it's time to slow down and reevaluate what's important rather than power through everything on the list. When you're feeling out of control and resentful of all you have to do, rather than roll up your sleeves and get to it, a better strategy is to relax, take a few deep breaths, and go for a short walk. You'll find that when you catch yourself getting too stressed out early, before it gets out of control, your stress will be like the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill. When it's small, it's manageable and easy to control. Once it gathers momentum, however, it's difficult, if not impossible, to stop. There's no need to worry that you won't get it all done. When your mind is clear and peaceful, and your stress level is reduced, you'll be more effective and you'll have more fun. As you lower your tolerance to stress, you will find that you have far less stress to handle, as well as creative ideas for handling the stress that is left over.
Once a week, write a heartfelt letter.
This is an exercise that has helped to change many lives, assisting people in becoming more peaceful and loving. Taking a few minutes each week to write a heartfelt letter does many things for you. Picking up a pen or typing on a keyboard slows you down long enough to remember the beautiful people in your life. The act of sitting down to write helps to fill your life with gratitude. Once you decide to try this, you'll probably be amazed at how many people appear on your list. I had one client who said, "I probably don't have enough weeks left in my life to write everyone on my list." This may or may not be true for you, but chances are there are a number of people in your life or from your past who are quite deserving of a friendly, heartfelt letter. Even if you don't have people in your life to whom you feel you can write, go ahead and write the letter to someone you don't know instead, perhaps to an author who may not even be living, whose works you admire, or to a great inventor or thinker from the past or present. Part of the value of the letter is to gear your thinking toward gratitude. Writing the letter, even if it isn't sent, would do just that. The purpose of your letter is very simple: to express love and gratitude. Don't worry if you're awkward at writing letters. This isn't a contest from the head, but a gift from the heart. If you can't think of much to say, start with short little notes like, "Dear Jasmine, I woke up this morning thinking of how lucky I am to have people like you in my life. Thank you so much for being my friend. I am truly blessed, and I wish for you all the happiness and joy that life can bring. Love, Richard." Not only does writing and sending a note like this focus your attention on what's right in your life, but the person receiving it will, in all likelihood, be extremely touched and grateful. Often, this simple action starts a spiral of loving actions, whereby the person receiving your letter may decide to do the same thing to someone else, or perhaps will act and feel more loving toward others. Write your first letter this week. I'll bet you'll be glad you did.
Imagine yourself at your own funeral.
This strategy is a little scary for some people, but universally effective at reminding us of what's most important in our lives. When we look back on our lives, how many of us are going to be pleased at how uptight we were? Almost universally, when people look back on their lives while on their deathbed, they wish that their priorities had been quite different. With few exceptions, people wish they hadn't sweated the small stuff so much. Instead, they wish they had spent more time with the people and activities that they truly loved, and less time worrying about aspects of life that, upon deeper examination, really don't matter all that much. Imagining yourself at your own funeral allows you to look back at your life while you still have the chance to make some important changes. While it can be a little scary or painful, it's a good idea to consider your own death, and in the process, your life. Doing so will remind you of the kind of person you want to be and the priorities that are most important to you. If you're at all like me, you'll probably get a wake-up call that could be an excellent source of change.
Repeat to yourself, "Life isn't an emergency."
In some ways, this strategy epitomizes the essential message of this audiobook. Although most people believe otherwise, the truth is, life isn't an emergency. I've had hundreds of clients over the years who have all but neglected their families as well as their own dreams because of their propensity to believe that life is an emergency. They justify their neurotic behavior by believing that if they don't work 80 hours a week, they won't get everything done. Sometimes I remind them that when they die, their in-basket won't be empty. A client who is a homemaker and mother of three children recently said to me, "I just can't get the house cleaned up the way I like it before everyone leaves in the morning." She was so upset over her inability to be perfect that her doctor had prescribed her anti-anxiety medicine. She was acting and feeling like there was a gun pointed at her head and the sniper was demanding that every dish be put away and every towel folded, or else. Again, the silent assumption was, this is an emergency. The truth was, no one other than she had created the pressure she was experiencing. I've never met anyone, myself included, who hasn't turned little things into great big emergencies. We take our own goals so seriously that we forget to have fun along the way, and we forget to cut ourselves some slack. We take simple preferences and turn them into conditions for our own happiness. Or we beat ourselves up if we can't meet our self-created deadlines. The first step in becoming a more peaceful person is to have the humility to admit that, in most cases, you're creating your own emergencies. Life will usually go on if things don't go according to plan. It's helpful to keep reminding yourself and repeating the sentence, "Life isn't an emergency."
Experiment with your back burner.
Your back burner is an excellent tool for remembering a fact or bringing forth an insight. It's an almost effortless yet effective way of using your mind when you might otherwise start feeling stressed out. Using your back burner means allowing your mind to solve a problem while you are busy doing something else here in the present moment. The back burner of your mind works in the same way as the back burner of a stove. While on low heat, the cooking process mixes, blends, and simmers the ingredients into a tasty meal. The way you prepared this meal was to throw the various ingredients into the pot, mix them up, and leave them alone. Often, the less you interfere, the better the result. In much the same way, we can solve many of life's problems, serious and otherwise, if we feed the back burner of our mind with a list of problems, facts and variables, and possible solutions. Just as when we make soup or a sauce, the thoughts and ideas we feed the back burner of our mind must be left alone to simmer properly. Whether you are struggling to solve a problem or can't remember a person's name, your back burner is always available to help you. It puts our quieter, softer, and sometimes most intelligent source of thinking to work for us on issues that we have no immediate answer for. The back burner is not a prescription for denial or procrastination. In other words, while you do want to put your problems on your back burner, you don't want to turn the burner off. Instead, you want to gently hold the problem in your mind without actively analyzing it. This simple technique will help you solve many problems and will greatly reduce the stress and effort in your life.
Spend a moment every day thinking of someone to thank.
This simple strategy, which may take only a few seconds to complete, has long been one of the most important habits I have ever engaged in. I try to remember to start my day thinking of someone to thank. To me, gratitude and inner peace go hand in hand. The more genuinely grateful I feel for the gift of my life, the more peaceful I feel. Gratitude, then, is worthy of a little practice. If you're anything like me, you probably have many people in your life to feel grateful for. Friends, family members, people from your past, teachers, gurus, people from work, someone who gave you a break, as well as countless others. You may want to thank a higher power for the gift of life itself or for the beauty of nature. As you think of people to be grateful for, remember that it can be anyone, someone who allowed you to merge into traffic, someone who held the door open for you, or a physician who saved your life. The point is to gear your attention toward gratitude, preferably first thing in the morning. I learned a long time ago that it's easy to allow my mind to slip into various forms of negativity. When I do, the first thing that leaves me is my sense of gratitude. I begin to take the people in my life for granted, and the love that I often feel is replaced with resentment and frustration. What this exercise reminds me to do is to focus on the good in my life. Invariably, as I think of one person to feel gratitude for, the image of another person pops into my head, then another, and another. Pretty soon, I'm thinking of other things to be grateful for: my health, my children, my home, my career, the readers of my books, my freedom, and on it goes. It may seem like an awfully simple suggestion, but it really works. If you wake up in the morning with gratitude on your mind, it's pretty difficult, in fact almost impossible, to feel anything but peace.
Smile at strangers, look into their eyes, and say hello.
Have you ever noticed or thought about how little eye contact most of us have with strangers? Why? Are we afraid of them? What keeps us from opening our hearts to people we don't know? I don't really know the answers to these questions, but I do know that there is virtually always a parallel between our attitude towards strangers and our overall level of happiness. In other words, it's unusual to find a person who walks around with her head down, frowning, and looking away from people who is secretly a peaceful, joyful person. I'm not suggesting it's better to be outgoing than introverted, that you need to expend tons of extra energy trying to brighten others' days, or that you should pretend to be friendly. I am suggesting, however, that if you think of strangers as being a little more like you and treat them not only with kindness and respect, but with smiles and eye contact as well, you'll probably notice some pretty nice changes in yourself. You'll begin to see that most people are just like you. Most of them have families, people they love, troubles, concerns, likes, dislikes, fears, and so forth. You'll also notice how nice and grateful people can be when you're the first one to reach out. When you see how similar we all are, you begin to see the